In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, following the truth wherever it leads, exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites, revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality, coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Hey there, friends. Welcome to another episode of Strange Planet. And if you'd like to get a little deeper into Strange Planet, you might want to consider becoming a premium subscriber. It's real easy to do. Just click on the link in the episode description, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. There are three subscriber tiers to choose from. You gain access to commercial-free listening, special bonus episodes produced exclusively for premium subscribers, and you also receive my monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. What really happened in Shelburne Harbor on October 12th, 1960? We're going to find out right now. It's a book by Chris Stiles called Sweep Clear 5, NATO's UFO Encounter. And Chris Stiles is an active UFO researcher who investigates select classic and current UFO incidents that have occurred in Atlantic Canada. He holds to a blended view of the UFO phenomena that allows room for both the ETH and significant psychological component. He's best known for his work on the 1967 Shag Harbor incident and has presented at several MUFON symposia in both Canada and the U.S. Chris served as a paid technical advisor with several Canadian UFO feature documentaries, such as Ocean Entertainment's The Shag Harbor Incident and Northern Lights. He's appeared in several U.S. UFO specials, such as Canada's Roswell and UFOs 2, Have We Been Visited? In 2019, Chris appeared in an episode of Ocean Mysteries with Celine and Fabian Cousteau. He is the author of two UFO books on the Shag Harbor incident, Dark Object with Don Ledger and Impact to Contact with Graham Sims. His most recent book, again, is Sweep Clear 5, NATO's UFO Encounter, available from Amazon in 2023. MUFON Canada presented Chris with an honorary membership in recognition of his lifetime achievement in ufology. Chris Stiles, welcome to Strange Planet. How are you?
I'm like a teenager, and it's a pleasure to be here, Richard.
Great to have
you. Looking forward to it.
Most people are familiar with the Shag Harbor incident in 1967. Mm-hmm. This one in Shelburne Harbor, 7 years earlier, most people are not familiar with. First of all, let's just kind of give us a little bit of a geography lesson. The Shelburne Harbor in relation to Shag Harbor.
It's about 25 miles away as the crow flies. And, you know, again, southwest Nova. It's that end of the province. Shag Harbor more or less faces and looks out into the Gulf of Maine, whereas Shelburne would more empty directly into the Atlantic Ocean. It's during the war, it served as a backup harbor for Halifax. And it's just a small town and community nowadays, but it used to be the location for Canada's most secret military base throughout the Cold War, which was Canadian Forces Station Shelburne, basically a U.S. base on Canadian soil. It was the coordination center for submarine detection in the Atlantic and connected 64 SOSIS stations, sonar, and had other systems come ashore there. It operated under a cover story, which the U.S. Navy has since admitted to. And that's where it all happened and played out.
So care to speculate as to why we know a fair bit about Canada's Roswell, as it's been called, Shag Harbor in 67, and so few of us probably know so little about the Shelburne incident?
Well, let me just say, first of all, with Shag Harbor, that when I started, even Stanton Friedman hadn't heard of it, that it was only my reinvestigation, which began in April 1992, that led to that. Shag Harbor, however, developed very quickly. And if there wasn't Shag Harbor, I would not have found the Shelburne case. Here's the strange thing. Shelburne masqueraded for years, and that's what I'd always felt, as the end of the story of the Shag Harbor incident. But people were always unable, that had told me this story, had witnessed it, had played some part in the role, were always reluctant and unable to give dates or, you know, what ships were involved. The telling of the story, the quality of it, you know, the witness testimony compelled me to believe that it was a genuine incident. But let me tell you, when I first heard it, it was first related to me. I can remember the very first time I heard the Shelburne story. It was Good Friday, 1994, almost exactly a year after I began researching Shag Harbor. And when I first heard it, you'd think, a lot of people thought, oh, wow, you know, this is what ufologists want to hear. This, it must have been exciting. Not at all. When I first heard it at the time, it was a year into Shag Harbor. I'd not been involved with any UFO group or attempted to do any research. It was purely personal interest. I'd had the guidance of people very early on, such as the late Stanton Friedman and others, you know, with Shag Harbor. But when I first heard this story, and it couldn't be any different, you know, made me think of Sesame Street, you know, where you have one of these things that's not like the other. Mm-hmm. And when I first heard it, I was really kind of cheesed off about it because, you know, suddenly I had this great little crash scenario that had all this mile wide paper trail, all this documentation, living witnesses, you know, so much heritage to it, right? And then this story, to me, which seemed quite separate as related by the Navy divers, where we're having aliens in the water, UFOs there, a dozen American ships, a dozen Canadian ships, a NATO mission gone wrong, and all this. And You know, I thought, here we go. And at the time, I was aware of the problems that began early on in the investigation of Roswell. And I thought, well, there goes my neat, clean, tidy, certain, well-documented UFO crash scenario. And now I've got more than one location, and I have, you know, aliens in the water and no paper and all this. And I wasn't the least bit excited about it. But, you know, you cannot pick and choose your data, right?
Right.
And, you know, but everybody around me was helping me at the time with Shag Harbor, local people like the late Bob McDonald, like Don Ledger and others, you know, their attitude was, well, gee, the Shelburne story, this is the meat and potatoes of it. And it's obviously, well, I wasn't in the mood for meat or potatoes. And I thought, you know, no. If this is true, this is a very separate case. There were little clues and things in it that just did not speak of 1967. And I'm going to tell you, as I ultimately found out and even have some memory of, the difference between 1960 and 1967 is huge. Yes, it's 7 years. But the attitude, I mean, in 1960, Dwight Eisenhower was still president, right?
Yes.
People still trusted their government. Imagine that.
Yeah.
It was a very different time.
Before the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah. 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 None of this had played out.
Can I just stop you for a minute, Chris, just for clarification?
You can.
Because earlier on you said that what ended up being the Shelburne Harbor incident in 1960 mm-hmm. got tagged on to the
yes.
end of the Shag Harbor incident. So in other words, somehow they became conflated.
Yeah, they did, because, you know, at the time, like I say, I was about a year into my reinvestigation, and initially I had found and talked to the fishermen, you know, to the reporters, you know, had done a lot of research in Ottawa, you know, had gone there physically and sat there and went through a lot of the paperwork. And, you know, those were heady days. I was so excited. Like, things happened very quickly. And as the document record demonstrated, it was quite clear the Canadian government believed that this was a genuine UFO incident, you know, and most likely the penetration of our skies and defense systems by something extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional, whatever. You know, so, you know, these were great things. And then suddenly, when I tried to find some of the divers, I got a list of all the seven divers who had dove on the Shag Harbor incident. As I tracked them down, the man who first put it on to me, who at the time was in charge of the Fleet Diving Unit at Maritime Command in Halifax, the first thing he said when I tracked him down and was asking who was there, he said, well, Chris, he goes, you know about Shelburne, don't you? And I said, well, gee, Shelburne, that's Shag Harbor's in Shelburne County. Is that what you mean? And he laughed. He said, oh, no. He says, Shelburne, he says, Shag Harbor was a UFO. And said, but Shelburne, he goes, there was no doubt. And, you know, the other guys with him, they'd all nod and say, no, there was no doubt of what was going on there. And I'd say, yeah, okay. And they go, well, when you talk to the guys at Dove, they'll tell you. And they gave me a list and said that a couple of the guys had dove on both incidents. You know, they had long careers. So yeah. I started with them, and especially with the advice that one was more apt to talk than the rest. And when I made the contact, and I called right away, there would have been no time to prep him or whatever. The first thing he said is, oh, yeah. He goes, you know about Shelburne, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And same thing. So I arranged to meet face-to-face and go to the home, and this diver told me this incredible story that in Shelburne Harbor, and, you know, I would ask him about Shag Harbor and my understanding of it, and he would say, oh, yeah, that was a UFO incident. By the time we got there, it was all over, though, you know, when the naval search began, you know. But he said that wasn't the case in Shelburne. We got there, things were still going on. And I'm saying, well, is this the same time, the same year? And he says, oh, no. The first guy says it was earlier. I couldn't tell you the year of the ships. He goes, I think it was back around the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, of course, was October 62.
Mm-hmm.
But none of the others could even name a date generally or whatever. He tells me that they were down there on a training mission for minesweeping. hence the name of the mission. And that was the actual name of the NATO mission, Sweep Clear 5.
Ah.
So, and, you know, in those days, Canada still had a 60-ship Navy, right? So we used to do a lot of NATO missions, right? In fact, we had a ship that was just geared up to be a floating command center for NATO missions, which was HMCS Cape Scott in Halifax, right? The Cape Scott was about 500 feet in length almost. It looked like a supply ship, but it was much more than that. It was a floating headquarters, a factory repair vessel, and had multiple roles, right? So anyway, you know, he was telling me this story, you know, and he said, well, we were down there, as he put it, I think it was frigging around with some British influence mines they had developed, you know. They always had us trying some new stuff out. And he said, we laid this course and we were about to go through it. And he said, my God, we started that day. We're only an hour into the mission. And there we are. We come upon these two UFOs sitting on the seabed. And he said, we're in shallow water. He said, we weren't worried about decompression or anything. And he goes, there's activity. And it was like pulling teeth at this point. And he said, I can't really go into it too much. I said, what do you mean activity? He goes, there were live aliens in the water around the craft.
Wow.
And yeah, so, you know, he tells me the story and it gets very reluctant to go into great detail. But, you know, it had the ring to truth. And when I would push his buttons, Richard, you'd see the emotion. Now, divers like this, you know, particularly somebody with a career, you know, as a clearance diver in the Navy, they do a lot of nasty work. They sometimes have to haul their friends out of down sea kings or crash and mishaps. And, you know, these guys, you know, we talked shop when I first went to the home on that Good Friday for some length. And this guy and his colleagues, when they open up, it was like, you know, it was emotional for them. And, you know, I never forgot that. And it was one of the reasons I didn't dispense with the story. But to be honest, I wasn't quite ready to go there. And I was very tough on myself all through the reinvestigation of Shag Harbor to come up with the paperwork, to come up with the proof, to investigate the alternate explanations. You know, I was my own skeptic, you know. And with Shelburne, it proved to be a much tougher nut to crack. And it, to be honest, as the book demonstrates, you know, when, you know, for those who venture through it, it took me 29 years to convince me that this was a genuine incident and that at that point I could name the ships, the date, you know, and what played out.
Sweep Clear 5, NATO's UFO encounter. Chris Stiles is with us. We'll take a quick time out, back with more of our conversation right after these.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the hosts of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
As you're staring up at the night sky, ever wonder who's staring back? You're listening to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Welcome back. You know about Canada's Roswell, the Shag Harbor UFO incident in 1967, but this is the Shelburne Harbor UFO incident, Sweep Clear 5. NATO's UFO encounter, Chris Stiles, is with us with a foreword by Martin Willis. After that first diver opened up to you about seeing two craft in shallow water off of Shelburne Harbor and actual entities, entities/divers on the outside or underwater on the outside of these craft, did he put you on to another diver that he was working with, you know, for corroboration?
Yes, he did. And unfortunately, the next diver wasn't in the Halifax area, and it was a phone interview. I always prefer being face-to-face over phone, over keyboard, over whatever. The more intimate, the better. I often include in lectures like the value of that. You know, you hear what's going on in the room. You see the reaction of a spouse or whatever, you know. And it's all part of, like, doing a proper investigation. But, yeah, he put me on to somebody else. And it was interesting because the other one eventually turned out to be a work colleague years later and somebody who, you know, I viewed with, you know, every bit of respect possible. And they told me essentially the same thing. And again, very reluctant witnesses, you know, confirmed the details. And, but I still didn't know what to do with it because I thought, you know, wow, what's the chance of getting any paperwork on this? The incredible thing is that the second witness that spoke to me in depth, you know, now these are the men who were actually there. They were under the water when it happened, when first contact is made. You know, he tells me that he actually filmed the event.
Wow.
You know, on underwater, like old, would have been 35 mil. Yeah. 35. And of course, which leads to the obvious question, what happened to this film? Where did it go? And I'll tell you the level, Richard, the degree of answer I was getting is that the film, you know, when a few days later, they were sent ashore from the ship while the ship was still holding station over these USOs, by the way. And they drove it to Halifax to the Defense Research Board on the Dartmouth side. There's a little brick building. It's still there to this day. And they turned it over to Dr. Maurice Coffey and Jason Greenblatt at the Defense Research Board. And of course, you know, being the Navy, you never hear back about it, right? I can remember the level of detail. They took it up in an old Army deuce and a half they used to call old Sid that was really kind of a cantankerous rig to drive and depend on, right? And they turned it over, and that's the last they ever hear about it, of course, right?
So the divers, they didn't give it to their superiors. I mean, were they attached to the HCMS Cape Scott or...
Yeah, they were actually, and that's significant too, because, you know, in 1960, things were a little different in the Canadian Navy. Again, one more thing that different put the distance between 67 and 60. In 1960, divers would be assigned to ships, and most, like Canadian naval ships, would have had at least two. that were stationed aboard, and diving was a trade then, you know. And the thing is, like, by 67, divers were just mostly pooled within the fleet diving unit and would be sent to whatever. But 1960, yeah, these guys were part of the ship. And, you know, but it was years before this unfolded because none of them wanted to name the ships. And,
I'm just curious as to why they wouldn't have been required to give that film footage to their superior, their commanding officer aboard the Cape Scott, rather than take it directly to that building in Dartmouth.
Well, I mean, it was brought up, like, I'd have to jump ahead because there were things. Okay, let's go there. You know, we only have a certain amount of time. Here's the big surprise that I find now. None of the men claimed this at the time. They'd said that when they first encountered, of course, they're like, what the, you know, they have that reaction. And when they're talking to the surface, you know, and let them know at first up, they're not believing what these guys are saying even for a minute. Once they realize it's true and confer with the sonar men and others, and they're saying, man, you know, we're shooting the film footage, right? They yank them out of the water. Everybody comes to the surface. And as they put it to me, all hell broke loose. And some of them used the term that we went to an emergency action station. Firearms were handed out as if we were being boarded. And you got to remember now, on this mission, Sweep Clarify, which again, I never learned until 2022, it was a NATO mission. There were 10 U.S. warships involved and 8 Canadian, plus a diving tender that would have been the size of a tugboat. And, you know, I can name all the ships because they were in Canadian waters within what was only a 12-mile limit then in outer Shelburne Harbor. They were under the command of the Cape Scott, whose captain was Commander Rankin at the time, Angus Rankin. The mission had been designed by Rear Admiral Kenneth Dyer. And he became kind of famous 2 years later during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's the Canadian admiral who went against Canadian orders and John Diefenbaker and took U.S. orders during the Cuban Missile Crisis directly and emptied the harbor in Halifax and went out and, you know, like hunted down Soviet subs and, you know, this kind of thing, right? That's a whole other story, although it's touched in the book. Unfortunately, I never got to interview Angus Rankin. He had been passed by the time I knew his role. But I had spoken to other admirals about this, including William Landy Moore, about this case, right, as it would surface. But here's the thing, here's the amazing thing, here's the first shock I got, was in 2022, when the case opens up to me, and this is all the result of a dream, by the way, it explains in the book, that causes me to look up something on Wikipedia, and one sentence changed everything. And I had spent years going through archives trying to find the date by accident using little clues that I would gain along the way. So much wasted effort at 40 cents a page from Ottawa often. Mm-hmm. But what happened was when I get in my hands in 2022 the actual ship's log for October of 1960, I follow the mission assembling down there. The ships, they all get lined up. And one of the first things they had to do, the Americans had gone down days before and laid a dummy minefield. And it was an 8-mile dog-laid course out at the entrance to Shelburne Harbor. And they begin in, and just like the diver had told me in 94. And by the way, when he tells me this story, it's 33 years old, the story, right, really?
Yes.
At this point, it's 63 years old or whatever when I finally have the ship's logbook in my hand, and I'm going through it, or a copy of it. And I get to, okay, their mission. The mission begins. It says entering swept channel. And he said about an hour in, all hell broke loose. I get to an hour, and I'm reading this, and oh, my God, there's so much jargon and naval thing because they're commanding 18 ships, right? There's all these communications. 60 minutes, nothing, and my heart's starting to sink a bit. Well, Richard, I get down to 90 minutes. We can allow them that discrepancy after all those years. I get to 90 minutes in, and suddenly I see something I never expected to see, and I've looked between Shag Harbor and other Marine cases. I'm used to going through logs and entries, and what do I find? assume DEFCON 1.
Yeah, you need to explain what that means.
Okay, in the DEFCON system, you have five levels of military readiness, right? Peacetime and everything at the lowest level would be five. If you look up on Wikipedia or something more scholarly, right, you will find that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the closest we were to nuclear war with the Soviet Union, we were at DEFCON 3 generally, and DEFCON 2, you know, for certain things, and that's the highest. It will tell you we've never been at DEFCON 1. This is not true. They're going to have to rewrite the history book here, because this is not an internet rumor. This is in the ship's log. Assume DEFCON 1.
Wow.
DEFCON 1 is like you're good to go.
Yeah.
You don't have to check with higher authority to deploy a weapon, you know, to shoot, right? Here's the other thing. Like, people say, well, Chris, why couldn't this have been a Soviet sub that gave Challenger come across the border? And there were lots of these stories, right? That it's a court-martial offense not to record an enemy vessel near one of these operations. And in fact, in the book I got, it was right on the flap of the book when it has the rules for the navigation officer. You would not do that. You know what I mean? Like, and no enemy vessels are reported, you know, in the area at the time, right? What's interesting is they have this encounter, they haul the men out of the water, they go to DEFCON 1, they lower lifeboats, and the men had told me that at the time they lowered lifeboats to put some debris in the boats that they'd picked up that they thought was foam and damage from one of the craft, you know?
Yes.
And they hoist it up, they go to DEFCON 1, they don't stay at that level, they drop it a bit after that. The ships drop anchor. They're huddled together at the mouth of Shelburne Harbor, just past what's known as McNutt's Island. They're in 7 fathoms, 42 feet of water. Now, if this had been a Russian sub, you could have almost looked over the side and see the conning tower sticking up out, right?
Right.
They sit there for a week, well, 4 days, really. The men always used to say a week, but it turned out it was 4 days, and never move, nobody lifts anchor or whatever, right? And the thing is, you know, that whole time, I mean, it's, oh, time to get up.
We're anyway, already awake. We're wide awake.
Yeah. And, you know, this was a shock, you know, and I checked so many things. You know, at the time, I'm sure there's probably been some since, I could only find one internet rumor, and I did some searching, of a declaration of DEFCON 1, and it was in West Germany back during the time of the wall, again in 1960.
Yes.
And radar detectors thought they had detected Russian bombers coming their way, but no one has ever proved it or found the paperwork a boy remembered from his father, and it just didn't hold water.
Well,
but here.
Sorry, but
go ahead.
How did you, was this a simple access to information request to get the logs from the HCMS Cape Scott, or did you have to fly through hoops to get this thing?
It was a simple request. However, remember, I didn't have the date or the names of the ships, right? And well, let me just tell this story why I requested it at all, because I had done years. In fact, I had written a chapter in a book that somebody else was going to publish about how I'd given up on the Shelburne story. I'm not known for giving up. I'm saying I believed what the men had told me. Should somebody walk in and drop it on my desk or give me that final clue, I would pursue it. But I'm done sitting in Ottawa or going, you know, I cried uncle. Okay. So, and it was Christmas, between Christmas Day and New Year's in 2022, right? And I went to bed. I stayed up all night watching PBR's worth of UFO stuff I'd missed during the holidays, you know, with relatives, friends, and people around. So I was ready to get into this. Mostly it was a rehash or follow-ups of the Tic Tac stuff and whatever. And I was interested. That's all great stuff, too. I eventually got tired, went to bed, as I put it, surrendered to the sacred night, and I had a dream. And I dreamt that I was 5 years old and under an end table and listening to my father's friends. My father was the medic on HMCS Cape Scott. He had never told me anything of the Shelburne mission or whatever. And I dreamt it, and I woke up, and I didn't trust the dream or whatever. The only thing it caused me to do, Richard, was I went to the computer, opened it up, went to Wikipedia, because I was trying to wonder, what is the classification of the Cape Scott? I knew Dad was on it. I knew it was a supply ship, but it was more than that. I read up on it. When I get to the service history of the ship, the last sentence says, in 1960, HMCS Cape Scott took part in a NATO mission called Sweep Clear 5 in Shelburne Harbor, period. That's all it says. Well, all the years of searching and all the logs, I had never was able to put any Canadian warship in Shelburne Harbor during the Cold War. So, except for a one-day visit, which was planned, announced weeks before by the Fraser in 67 to show off our new invention, the Bear Trap, which allows them to land helicopters on the deck, and they were going to go to Washington to show it off to the Americans. So I saw that and I thought, oh my God, that's got to be it. And I was like, don't get too excited. It was the holidays. The next day I went to a used bookstore and went through old military magazines, figuring it would take a couple of months to have any bragging rights or coverage. The Navy used to have a magazine called The Crow's Nest. I found a copy from December 1960. Ironically, had the Bounty on the cover because they were making the movie with Marlon Brando.
Right.
Anyway, I read, and here was coverage of Sweep Clear 5. It named all the ships, Canadian and American, involved in the mission, what the mission was supposed to be about, said who was the admiral that designed the mission at Maritime Command, which was Ken Dyer, who was in charge, et cetera, right? And when you read it, it was like one of those typical naval articles. Oh, and a good time was had by all. No life like it, right? So I had that, and I thought, well, I got to put in these requests. The first thing, though, was I went back to the computer because I had ships' names, right? And I started looking them up. And the first thing I found was, you read the Canadian thing, a good time was had by all. I go to the American version. Well, there was nothing under Sweep Clear 5. But when I look at the service history of ships like USS Yazoo, which was part of the mission, I look at the Yazoo, and it says that on October 15th, a few days afterwards, HMCS Cape Scott had to be rescued by USS Yazoo, which had complete engine failure and was drifting and going to ground on the shore of Shelburne Harbor. And at the last minute, she had been ordered with all ships to leave the harbor immediately. And it had to go back and tow the Cape Scott to safe anchorage. So that, and on and on and on, there was these discrepancies. So I thought, wow, I got to go right to the source. The first thing I found was that when I tried to request, I wanted one of the ships that had been a diving tender, but supposedly its log hadn't been preserved. The diving tender's log, the YTM-8, hadn't been preserved, and it wasn't looking good. So I thought, well, let's go right for the command ship. And they did have Cape Scott. It took 7 months to get it beyond the act. And I've had some experience with that. I only had that happen once before. But when it came and I started to sift through it, lo and behold, there it was. And the first, my first reaction, of course, to back up a bit, when I saw the Wikipedia article, oh my God, my father was there, because I knew he was posted on the boat in those early years. Wow. DEFCON 1, Dad was there.
Oh, my Lord.
And then I got the thing, and things went a little quicker from there. But there's a lot to do yet on this case. But, after 29 years, I had to get a book out. I'm just like, oh, my God, it was like a weight off my shoulder, Richard. It was a vendetta. It was a quest.
We'll take another time out, Chris. Mind-blowing stuff. Stay with us.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Every Town podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again. and Elizabeth Shove from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. We give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Everytown podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you. Now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Lincoln County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
The truth will set you free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Chris Stiles stays with us, Canadian UFO researcher, of course, best known for his work on the famous Shag Harbor UFO incident. But this one predates Shag Harbor by more than 7 years. And it's the October 12th, 1960 Shelburne Harbor. I guess we should call it a USO incident.
Correct. Yes.
Prior to the discovery of these craft on the bottom of Shelburne Harbor in about, I think you said 6 fathoms of water.
Yeah.
Were there any incidents, lights in the sky prior to that, or is this strictly an unidentified submerged object incident?
Yes, there were no civilian witnesses to this, right? It's possible that the nearby lighthouse on McNutt's Island may have seen something enter, but the lighthouse logs for this period, again, were unavailable. There's a lot of unavailable. So I was very lucky to get the command ship on this, believe me. The other thing that was interesting, so many things, you know, and you find this in the book, of course, is that these guys who, the couple that dove, and only one of them had a career that overlapped, it turned out in the end, with, you know, the Shag Harbor divers. He never spoke of Shelburne to them. Believe it or not. The next group of divers that I heard about it, and they had secondhand information, and they heard openly all about the case, were the women in the so-called 1984 experiment that were the first officers to take command and become RCN divers on the Cormorant in 1984. And one, the diver who had dove on both missions, was a consultant and a trainer to them. And he felt comfortable talking to them because whenever he tried to talk to the guys, you know, that he worked with in the years afterward that hadn't been at Shelburne, you'd tell the story, you'd mention it, they'd all make the sound of a theremin or whatever, right? But this next generation of divers, these women, right, they felt comfortable. They grew up, they were the generation lost in space. They accepted it at face value. And this gentleman felt comfortable relating it to them. And I found that very interesting and a little sad, you know. But, you know, there was, of course, rumors of this within the community of Shelburne, because Shelburne also had what was, again, Canada's most secret base, the Coordination Center for Submarine Detection, right? And, you know, these things circulated in the community. The other thing you got to remember about that, it's another example of how I say, Richard, one of these things is not like the other. Because in 67, this base was shared 50-50, like a NORAD arrangement. Mm-hmm. But in 1960, it was U.S. only. right? Blue only, Old Glory. You know, if you worked there, you had to be in U.S. forces, right? So they had control of this. I mean, they were caught unprepared in this, and it was amazing that they were able to keep this so dark and such a lid. But then again, the function of the base was hid until there was a scandal in the 90s because they dismissed five officers, accused them of being in an open lesbian relationship and, you know, vulnerable to espionage. Gay service members had no rights then, you know. Mm-hmm. But in 1960, you see, U.S. base only, you have this, you know, this top secret base nearby operating under a cover story. You know, it was all a sensitive thing, right? And we were unprepared. The defense minister at the time, Doug Harkness, under John Diefenbaker, assumed the job, get this, the day before on October the 11th of 1960. So, you know, they were all caught napping on this.
Back to the divers that saw these craft on the ground, the bottom of the Shelburne Harbor. How much detail did they get into in describing the entities and the craft themselves?
It was like pulling teeth, that part of the interview. You know, several times, like, they'd look at the ground and, you know, they wouldn't, what I mean, or the floor of their kitchen or whatever, they wouldn't maintain eye contact, and they'd put out their hand and say, Chris, you have to move on. We can't talk about that. But eventually, the details revealed that these were typical grays in the water. I couldn't get comment about equipment if they required special diving or whatever. Again, we're in a maximum of 42 feet of water at 7 fathoms. But yeah, they were typical grays, and they sat over this thing, and we do know from the ship's log, of course, there were no mention of, you know, there never is in deck logs why things happen. Simply that, you know, a ship was sunk or men were hurt or a chopper. What we do know afterwards is the man who, is infamous in Canadian history for taking U.S. orders through the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, Admiral Kenneth Dyer. and you know, the jury's out on him. People describe him as a hero or somebody who circumvented democracy. Those are your choices, right? He flew out to the mission after this for what it calls a hot wash-up meeting with the Americans aboard ship on the Cape Scott. And here's what we do know. Are you ready for this? Yeah. Is that there was an incident aboard ship, and it happened to be one of the divers that spoke to me. That's all I'll say. These are the only two men that have, a pseudonym in the book, right? In fact, I reveal the actual names of all the Shag Harbor divers and explain why I do that in it, because they'd gone public and hadn't even realized it somewhere else. Anyway, here's the thing. While they're having this hot wash-up meeting, a protocol officer wanders downstairs into the mess, you know, and he's kind of interested because, hey, there's liquor aboard, Canadians are drinking, right? He goes in. The divers are sitting in a quarter in a huddle, and they were there. They'd been for days, and somebody else who had worked with another work colleague who was Air Force remembered this and told me this story years later. I connected. I couldn't believe he'd been on the mission. He was there for a consultant. They never showed him anything. And he said, it's the strangest mission I ever been on. He said, I'll tell you what was going on. And here's, these guys were in the corner talking about what they were sitting over. This U.S. officer doesn't like this, the way they're talking openly. He walks over and leans in on them, says, guys, he goes, you shouldn't be talking shop. At least you guys get a beer. We have to have just a Coke. He said, you shouldn't be talking about that Soviet sub we're sitting over. Mm-hmm. And one of the divers, the fella, it turned out I interviewed, just explodes. He jumps up and the table goes over. He grabs the American and he says, that's the trouble with you Yankee boys. You see the red menace everywhere. He said, the Red Menace that we're over, he goes, it's not from Moscow or the Black Sea. He goes, it might be Mars. He goes, I suspect a lot farther away. He says, if it wanted to do something, we wouldn't be able to do anything. And, he said, I don't know what's going to happen next, but I hope you guys don't decide to go all John Wayne on it. And he let go of the guy, and the American ran up, and they came back down with the captain, but he goes off tells him to go sleep it off or he's going to the brig, right? You know, and that occurred down below while they were having the so-called, I love that, hot wash-up meeting with the Americans aboard the ship. They flew them out in helicopters. And by the way, I've had people say to me, stand up to think, you know, 1960 said you couldn't land it on a destroyer. No, but you could land a Labrador on the Cape Scott. It had a special deck, even back then, before the conversion, right?
Ah, so you had mentioned earlier that the Cape Scott had become immobilized somehow and was drifting, was at risk of coming ashore. Any connection between it, because that diver just said, you know, if this craft wanted to do something.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's tempting to speculate. I'll tell you what I do know about it, because, you know, deck logs are very sketchy, right? And you have to understand the jargon. I'll tell you what it does say is when they first call Maritime Command in Halifax and say cannot comply with order to leave harbor, complete, you know, engine failure, maintaining real slow revs, you know, and they can't fight the wind and they're drifting toward the shore, right? And they want permission to drop anchor and they're told, no, leave the harbor. Well, we can't do it. Go, get out. Like, so something was going on right then and there, right? And this is where the Yazoo comes back and rescues her, you know. So you have to combine, you know, the oral testimony I'd gotten, right? Now, there are no documents beyond this log to date, but luckily, between the interviews I'd done over the years, including with Admiral Andy Moore about this, he wasn't there. He was, at the time, captain of the Bonaventure, actually. You know, we have these insights, right? But, you know, you do have to piece it together. As far as the film goes and all that, I don't even know that Ottawa or others would know or have had access to it. You know, once it went to DRB, and there's a whole chapter in the book that explains how they operated under themselves and answered to no one, that the bench scientists there picked their mission. It was very unusual. This had been set up since the creation of the Defense Research Board. It was a compromise to bring the Navy in, because the Navy was actually its own Defense Research Board. Get this, it started in 42 during World War II.
Wow.
And they had in that facility, and even to this day, if you look up on Wikipedia about, it's currently called, what is it, Research and Development Canada or whatever. If you look at it now, it explains on there that their mission is a little different from all the other divisions here in Dartmouth. And I love this. One of the mission statement, one of the things they do is control, what is it, information and release about maritime matters, you know, but they keep a lid on everything anyway. But they answer to nobody. They have a black budget and that's it.
Don't you think this should be Canada's UFO, Canada's Roswell? I mean, Shag Harbor, pretty spectacular in terms of documentation, but in terms of the...
I agree. Yeah, because the documentation in Shag Harbor, just nobody had pursued it, you know, before me. It was always unrestricted from source, right? This one, while nobody there could acknowledge that, you know, or is in a position to. And it's dubious how much Ottawa would know about this, or Washington in one sense. The men knew who were there. But this film, for example, at DRB, you know, I suspect knowing these scientists and following their career and even interviewing their family members and you know, people, you know, early on like Salant in Ottawa and how they looked at this. It's did he pull a Phil Corso? Did they take this film? Did they just put it in the door and keep it as an academic study from them, right? This would not be beyond the possibility for them, right? And you know, it just slept into the dustbin of history. I could tell you this, the daughter, Marcia Coffey, of Dr. Coffey, who would have been one of the two scientists who received the film, he used to take his daughter on walks and tell her he wished he could talk about it. He says, I'm absolutely sure we're not alone. I've seen the proof at work.
Wow. Sweep Clear 5, NATO's UFO Encounter, Chris Stiles, foreword by Martin Willis. Absolutely astounding information, Chris. Thank you so much for this.
Yeah. Well, you know, this it's early days yet in this investigation, right? We have a big conference in Yarmouth this year. We have every year down there. And I'm hoping, it's been a thing last year, a lot of naval personnel came to tell their stories to me personally. I suspect there's a lot more. And when I think about how long and how we still find new things on the Shag Harbor incident, all of which strengthen the interpretation of it being something, you know, I think this year that in September, it's the last weekend of September, and we have this, I'm hoping more people come forward to tell me their stories, right? And that's why the book at the front is dedicated to these men. You know, there was nothing in it for them to tell this story, you know? And, you know, they were often expected to deal with the unknown. They come face to face. They had no training for it, and they weren't even allowed to acknowledge that it happened.
This has to go down as one of the most important UFO or USO cases ever. Great work, Chris.
Thank you so much, Richard.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.